Good evening. You may have realised from the programme we're now bang on in the middle of the seminar series, and we're very firmly now moving on to British soil, which is quite good. So the next three papers are about British or English and Scottish topics. But luckily, we have Leslie today, who's going to go straight into the issue and talk to us about it. And Leslie needs little introduction to people at Brooks. Some of us who have worked on the history of eugenics abused her generosity by using the contacts and indeed the openness of the archive at the Wellcome Library, the Archive of the Eugenics Society. Others, simply because Leslie is such a nice person, wanted to be in contact with her. She's published extensively on many issues, but in particular some of them are relevant, I think, for our conversation today. One is, of course, eugenics, the other one is feminism, women's fiction, or how shall I put it, women's history, but from a more literary point of view. Also, she published extensively on the Victorian period, and I'm very pleased to announce it that the second edition of her classic book, which is Sex, Gender and Social Change in Britain, since 1880, yeah. Those of you who haven't read it, it's a compulsory reading for those who are working on this period. Today's talk is about a writer that is quite dear, if I may say so, to Leslie's interests, and that's Naomi Mitchinson, Haldane's sister. And the title is, very interestingly, put Sending the Clones, Naomi Mitchinson's Musings on Reproduction and Breeding, Feminism, Socialism and Eugenics in Britain from the 1920s to the 1970s. Without further ado, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marius. Oh, good afternoon. Naomi Mitchinson led a long, diverse and active life spanning the 20th century before she died in 1999 at the age of 101. She's probably less well known than she might be, quite possibly because of the diversity of her output and activities. After a prolific career writing path-breaking historical fiction, contemporary novels, children's fictions, and fantasy, in her 60s she turned to science fiction, producing the novels Memoirs of a Space Woman, 1962, Solution 3, 1975, and Not by Bread Alone, 1983, as well as a number of short stories in the genre. And these works are of significant interest both in terms of their relationship to the development of the genre of science fiction and for the ideas they specifically engage with. In his recent study, Reproduction by Design, Sex, Robots, Trees and Test Tube Babies in Interwar Britain, Angus McLaren has demonstrated the extent to which issues about reproduction, fertility and breeding were being expressed and debated in fiction and a variety of non-fictional texts between the wars in Britain. Mitchinson was positioned absolutely centrally within the flux of these ideas. Her brother was the communist geneticist and populariser of science J.B.S. Haldane. Her brother's wife, Charlotte, wrote both dystopic fiction and a polemic on modern motherhood. Aldous and Julian Huxley were close family friends. They were so close that in her girlhood, the usual rules of chaperonage had been waived in their favour. So they were like honorary brothers. She was in contact with H.G. Wells, and she was active in the birth control movement. She was a somewhat conflicted member of the Eugenics Society. She was part of the feminist circle around the journal Time and Tide and heavily involved in Labour politics, supporting her husband as he pursued election as a Labour MP. Besides being an author, a prolific author, she had a long career of political and social engagement. She married rather young in the fervour of the early months of the First World War. She later commented rather dryly in her memoir, All Change Here, "I might have said yes to the first man, I beg your pardon, officer in uniform who asked me to marry him in August 1914. In spite of early difficulties in their marriage, she and her husband, Dick Mitchison, a lawyer and Labour politician, worked out an affectionate and open relationship. They had seven children, one of whom who died in childhood from meningitis and the last dying shortly after birth. She led a vigorous social life with numerous intense relationships, both sexual and non-sexual. She travelled extensively, was involved in left-wing politics both in Britain and internationally, became active in Scottish local politics and in Scottish nationalism. And at an age when many individuals will be sitting back and taking things easy, was caught up in the affairs of the Bagatla tribe in Bechuanaland just before, during and after its independence under the name of Botswana. Her father, John Scott Haldane, and her brother, Jack Haldane, JBS Haldane, won fame for their ventures in scientific self-experimentation in connection with mine safety, deep sea diving, and poison gas protection. But Naomi, I would argue, lived an experimental life, trying out new ways of living and being that were only just becoming available to women. She was greatly attracted by the paradigm of participant observation for research. She was a mass observation diarist, and extracts from her wartime diary for MO have been published as Among You Taking Notes. Before the First World War, as a young girl, Naomi and her brother kept guinea pigs. They used them to study genetics, but she also gradually began to study them in a semi-scientific sense, listening to, identifying and copying their various squeaks and chitters, and seeing their relationship with one another and the whole pattern of guinea pig likes and dislikes. I even started taking notes. I certainly anthropomorphise too much, but I don't suppose anyone else has ever watched guinea pigs this way. Scientifically, they are an exploited race. Naomi herself became a guinea pig for contraceptive research, personally trying out new methods, as did many women birth control activists at the same period. She also took mescaline under medical supervision during the 1960s as an experimental guinea pig, quote, presumably as part of the general 60s interest in the mind expanding and potentially therapeutic use of psychotropic drugs. In fact, she found the experience of taking mescaline deeply unpleasant and disturbing, and had kind of ongoing subsequent flashbacks from it. Throughout her writing, the other is not something alien to be feared and attacked, but to be encountered with interest, communicated with, understood, and even loved, rather like the guinea pigs of her youth. In Memoirs of a Space Woman, 1962, the protagonist, Mary, encounters radial starfish-like intelligences on her first planetary expedition. She decides that I had better go around on hands and knees so as to be at the same aesthetic level, and yes, very much a participant-observer model. Because Mitchison's novels are at first glance good reads, they're written in an easy and accessible, fluent style, the extent to which she was working out political and social ideas through the medium of fictional characters and their problems has been undervalued by literary historians and critics. Furthermore, the ideas are embedded in the narrative and the interaction of the characters rather than being detachable. You don't get the whole kind of banging on philosophizing that you tend to get in Aldous Huxley, for example. And I think she's very much about raising questions rather than giving answers. It's only very recently that the sophistication of Mitchison's fiction has begun to receive anything like its due, and she still remains understudied and less valued as a significant 20th century writer than she should be. In this paper, I shall be considering how she presented certain issues around breeding and reproduction in her post-war science fiction, in which, I would argue, she engaged in a highly nuanced dialogue with ideas that had proliferated in the early part of the century in the milieu in which she was embedded, and which were by no means entirely superseded by the time she was writing. During the interwar period, she was writing historical fiction, a genre she played an important part in transforming. And when she starts out, basically historical fiction is all kind of costume drama by My Halidom, Stanley Vittles, and she brings a kind of gritty realism with working in ideas from archaeology and anthropology. She wrote a controversial contemporary novel, We Have Been Warned, which ends with a dystopic vision of a fascist coup. What I would think of as a Carolean fantasy beyond this limit, and numerous non-fiction works on a diverse range of topics, as well as copious journalism. It was not until the 60s that she turned to science fiction, possibly as a result of her long friendship with Olaf Stapledon, a lecturer at Liverpool University and author of several acclaimed and very influential novels in the genre. It might seem surprising that Mitchison, the daughter, sister, and mother of distinguished scientists, brought up by a feminist mother and with examples before her of women working in scientific fields as well as other fields of endeavour, did not herself become a scientist. However, her memoirs reveal an almost paradigmatic instance of the plight of daughters of educated men, as Virginia Woolf delineated them in her novel, her polemic, Three Guineas. Mitchison's memoir of childhood, Small Talk, casts a detached, almost anthropological eye on her privileged upper middle class intellectual elite background. Both her parents were Scottish agnostics, but from rather different traditions. Her father from the liberal Presbyterian Haldanes, and her mother from the Tory Episcopalian Trotters of Edinburgh. Maya, as Mitchison's mother was called, combined dedicated support of the British Empire with strongly held, if non-militant, suffragist convictions. Mitchison noted, however, that this genuine feminism was somewhat marred by the counterforce of being a lady, and Maya deplored the deeply unladylike conduct of the militant suffragettes, even while believing it wrong that women should not have the vote. The family lived in Oxford, where her father maintained a home laboratory and was a fellow of New College. His particular interest in the physiology of breathing led him into work around poisonous gases and occupational health, and he was often called out to investigate mining disasters. As well as the common ailments of childhood, Naomi suffered from constant winter illness of a vague kind, coughs, cough mixtures, being sick and having nightmares. More serious were the concussion after a fall when out for a walk, and a compound fracture of the femur requiring several operations and extensive physiotherapy following a fall from a pony. Although she drank only boiled milk, she had to undergo an operation for tuberculous neck glands. Possibly it was these health problems that led to her sharing her mother's bedroom from the age of 10 onwards. However, she remarked, looking back on this from later life, that she was fairly certain that my presence was to ensure that my father should not be allowed in, which was one of the kind of standard forms of contraception in the late Victorian, early Edwardian era. This may also have been one of the reasons why there was little family enthusiasm for Naomi going to boarding school. She attended the Dragon Preparatory School in Oxford, one of the very few girls there, but her parents removed her at the first signs of puberty. She then shared an amiable but not very intellectually stimulating governess with several other girls from families in a similar social position. Blockywocks, or Miss Blocky, had no particular qualifications as a teacher, but possibly the ability to please mothers. By her teens, Naomi could see that she had slipped behind her old school contemporaries. And through her childhood, as she had demonstrated an interest in botany, guinea pig genetics, and I think her study of guinea pigs was what we would now call animal ethology. But while her mother, who supported women in the professions, went to women doctors whenever possible and encouraged Naomi to think of a medical career, the practical requirements of pursuing such a course were apparently neglected. And though her father had female colleagues, he doesn't seem to have had any kind of idea that his daughter might take up science in any kind of professional way. Her father's sister, Elizabeth Haldane, was an independent woman, active in voluntary organisations and local government, travelled extensively, wrote on philosophy and literature, even though, because she was the unmarried daughter and sister of the family, she was expected to undertake substantial family obligations. So within the Haldane circle, there was an idea that women might pursue serious careers in a range of fields. But prioritisation of being a lady seems to have strongly inflected attitudes towards Naomi's future. She would not need to pursue a career for financial reasons, and it was expected that she would marry. She came out in 1914, though her parents insisted that this was merely temporary so that she could attend her brother's commembals at Oxford. In spite of the defects of her governess, she successfully passed the Oxford local examinations, became a home student at St Anne's College. There, she enjoyed biology, struggled with physics and chemistry, and took extra lectures in genetics. But she never proceeded to, well, it wouldn't actually have been a degree before the First World War at Oxford because women weren't granted degrees, but the equivalent. The failure to pursue a university career was at least partly due to the historical moment, as the First World War radically disrupted life for all social classes. And during the heightened emotions following the outbreak of war, Naomi became engaged to her brother's friend Dick Mitchison. As with many other girls of her day, marrying a man who was going to war seemed almost like war work itself. And her involvement in the great excitement was thus already underway when she started going to Red Cross first aid classes. Even so, she did continue her studies and was also beginning to encounter ideas and ideologies very different from her mother's. Like so many of her female contemporaries, Naomi became impatient with her position of relative non-involvement in the war effort and nagged to be allowed to join the voluntary aid detachment, with which her aunt was one of the founders, and to work as an auxiliary nurse at St Thomas's Hospital in London. She was still too young to be sent abroad as a VAD. She took with her, when she went to St Thomas's, a batch of guinea pigs to continue the genetic experiments. But this was pursued under considerable difficulties because VAD work was rigorously disciplined and the schedules were very inflexible. Her nursing experience shattered many of the taboos around the human body she had grown up with, thrust her into close and painful contact with horror and suffering, and this was reflected in her post-war historical novels. She moved increasingly leftwards in politics, although unlike her brother Jack, she never joined the Communist Party. And while admiring many aspects of the Soviet experiment, she also had qualms about some of the other aspects. She thought there was something still a bit male about the attitudes of much of that was going on in Russia. She had connections with the Eugenic Society and the sort of wider penumbra of people around it, something that was, I think, quite common among birth control activists of the period. Her relationship with the Eugenic Society was uneasy. She was well informed about modern genetics and possibly had a rather more sophisticated understanding of the complexities of inheritance than some of the more committed members of the society, some of whom seem to have had a rather simplistic and thoroughly non-Mendelian approach to inheritance. She had, as demonstrated in her later memoirs and other writing dealing with her family and ancestry, a certain pride in her own heredity, although this was not unqualified. In a letter to Cora Hodson of the Eugenic Society in 1929, she mentioned that there were several epileptics in the latter generation of her mother's family, and added that she had made up my mind early on not to marry anyone belonging to a Scottish family which was in any way related to my own. And I think this is very much the kind of contemporary eugenically inflected concern over personal matters of breeding that we see quite often in queries sent to the Eugenic Society and indeed expressed by correspondence to Mari Stopes. By the early 1930s, Naomi told Carlos Peyton Blacker, the General Secretary of the Eugenic Society, that she felt she should resign since the general trend of opinion in the society was out of tune with my own position of one who wants to see the present state of society completely altered and new sets of social and individual values substituted for the old ones. I also feel very doubtful about such measures as the sterilisation of the unfit. They put such a terrible power into the hands of a government and bureaucracy which may yet prove tyrannous. Her 1934 work on the home and a changing civilisation reflects her concern over the rise of fascism in Europe and the more general backlash against women's emancipation. I should perhaps add that she doesn't seem to have resigned from the Eugenic Society, in fact appears to have been a life member, but we don't actually have Blacker's letter to her, at least I haven't seen it, in which he managed to persuade her to stay, and he was very persuasive and he was very keen to keep the birth control, keep ties, pathways open between the Eugenic Society and the birth control movement more generally. During this interwar period, she did not express her ideas in the medium of science fiction, even though there was a significant tradition in British literary circles of using scientific speculations as the basis for fiction. Her childhood friend Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, 1932, is probably the best known example, but her sister-in-law, Charlotte Haldane, had published A Man's World in 1926. And towards the end of Mitchison's We Have Been Warned, Dionne, the heroine, has a vision of a fascist coup in Britain, the feared outcome of political trends already delineated throughout the contemporary narrative, but it is just a vision, it's not actually worked through, what would happen under fascism. It's not like Burdekin's Swastika Night, for example. So far, I haven't managed to work out why in her 60s she turned towards science fiction as a medium to explore ideas in a way similar to that in which she had deployed historical fiction to dramatise various political and social issues. Possibly it was her friendship with Olaf Stapledon, but her science fiction is really quite different from his. She admired his cosmic history, Star Maker, which she read in manuscript, but suggested that she most enjoyed the parts that were about people who aren't impossibly remote, and she exhorted Stapledon to avoid encouraging the idea of the patriarchy and not to make God so male, capital letters, all the time. Rather than being concerned with transcendence and the post-human, Mitchison's SF is very much about being human, about the limits and potential of that state. In her foreword to Solution 3, she remarked of SF, "The interest of writing novels is to see what people will do in situations which one has invented for them. This seems to me to be supremely so in SF. There are, of course, SF fans who are more interested in the details of the invented situations than in the people. And equally, there are SF writers who are better at handling the situation than the characters. I was brought up to biology rather than physics. Perhaps this shows through." Her scientist characters manifest her deep understanding of what it means to be a scientist based on her personal acquaintance with numerous distinguished scientists from her earliest years on to several generations younger than herself. Her characters are not just scientists, but workers in specific disciplines who look at things with a particular slant. Like other SF writers of the period during which she was writing, she used the genre to raise questions rather than provide pat answers. At a time when most science fiction was technologically orientated and often unthinkingly replicated rather than exploring or contesting contemporary gender attitudes, as feminist criticism of the genre has shown, Mitchison took her own advice to Stapledon in eschewing a patriarchal vision of the future and of the cosmos. Her narrative in Memoirs of a Space Woman, 1962, is not just about the exploration of strange new planets and encountering the alien, but has a strong interweaving strand in the carpet about love and reproduction in the life of the protagonist, Mary, whose career path as an explorer centers on getting into communication with alien beings who may have very different modes of expression. In the episode on the planet of the radial entities, the subplot of her attraction to her colleague Omakase introduces the motif of ways in which scientific observations can be unconsciously biased. I made a most ludicrous mistake about their sex life, all due to my own anthropomorphizing. Doubtless my subconscious was firmly fastened on myself and to O. And the first manifestation of the theme of reproduction and parenthood, in particular maternity, that pervades Memoirs of a Space Woman, appears when the narrative introduces the possibility of To'o and Mary having a child together. In the tense aftermath of disaster to a later expedition, the androgynous alien Vly, of a species which uses its sexual organs for tactile communication, inadvertently activates, not fertilizes, one of Mary's ova, leading to the development of a haploid fetus, and Mary decides to bear this child, whom she names Viola. This unexpected outcome of a traumatic disaster, Mary remarks that under more normal circumstances she would have terminated the activation, becomes Mary's most loved child and one who, because she redoubles Mary's own communication abilities, by the end of the book is likely to make remarkable breakthroughs in spite of the adverse and physical and health effects of her haploid condition. The narrative contrasts the much-loved accident Viola with Mary's second child, whose father Mary chooses almost too sensibly and deliberately, producing a son she describes rather tepidly as intelligent and satisfactory. And this resonates with Mitchison's remarks in her 1930 pamphlet Comments on Birth Control and in The Home in a Changing Civilization a few years later, in which she rather deplored what she feared was becoming the new tyranny of the carefully planned and limited family with no room for spontaneity and surprise. The male characters in Memoirs of a Space Woman are frequently assessed for their potential as fathers. At one point, Mary has an affair with a smoothie from the Minerals Ministry, who is a pleasing way of passing the odd half hour when nothing more important is happening. But she considers that he would be a most unsuitable father. One does, after all, demand more than good looks and expertise. Whereas she later has a child with her fellow explorer and mentor, Peder Pedersen, and wonders why there had not been a rush to choose him as a father. This undercurrent in Memoirs of a Space Woman both recalls the early 20th century feminist eugenics of female choice unfettered by the economic and social considerations that bore upon Victorian Edwardian women, and also perhaps Pope's oblique criticism at the kind of contemporary science fiction which tended to assume that women's prime value lay in their sexual attractiveness and capacity as breeders. There was certainly a sort of subgenre at the time of expedition is wrecked on a distant planet, and immediately, you know, the women must start having babies to keep humanity going. So I think she's kind of gesturing against that. The situation of Viola, this, you know, child who is an accidental child, has interesting thematic links to another episode on which one might call the episode of the Butterfly Planet. This is a long, it's almost self-contained episode in which Mary joins an all-woman biological group expedition to a habitable planet and confronts a fairly complex moral problem. They encounter large caterpillar-like creatures that clearly manifest consciousness and intelligence. They make elaborate and pleasing patterns with shiny coloured pellets that they evacuate. They also engage in what appears to be some kind of quasi-sexual communal wallowing in algae bogs that they inhabit. While Mary and her fellow scientist, the botanist Olga, explore further, they're prevented from picking a flower by large butterflies, which send out painful stings and prickles and a psychic attack evoking sensations of guilt and misery. As a result, they hypothesize that the caterpillars are the larval form of the butterflies. While the team are affectionately observing the caterpillars, a group of butterflies arrive and turn on the caterpillars, a similar psychic attack, making them feel bad without any idea of why or how. It was as though they were being hurt from inside themselves by some unrecognized power. They're not physically damaged, but they're hurt and miserable, and their previous joyous vitality vanishes. And shortly after this, the caterpillars move as a group into a grove where they climb trees and assume a chrysalis form. As Mary waits there watching, from one of the older chrysalids, a butterfly starts to emerge, communicating on the psychic level of butterflies, communicate pain and distress. Other butterflies arrive to assist and soothe, but then they burn another emerging butterfly with blame and guilt because it's defective. But as they fly off with the first one, they communicate a sensation of astonishing joy, a sense of justification, almost of complete virtue. One of the butterflies manages to communicate to Mary that the defective butterfly was thus because of some fault in its own nature. And she wonders if the butterflies really have any memory at all of their early caterpillar state. And the butterflies do believe that things that the caterpillars do have some effect on the development into butterflies. The pattern making is alleged to adversely affect the developments of their wings. It externalizes patterns that should remain internal. And the butterflies also condemn the bog wallowing because they believe that this fertilizes the caterpillars and they will become butterflies who lay eggs. And this kills the butterflies, not merely from the physical stress and trauma, but out of despair at passing on life to huge numbers of lowly forms, most of which will never attain bliss. Mary notes that the anguish that the butterflies undergo in giving birth has no recompense, as it would with a human, in feelings of pride in creation and the development of maternal feelings. The eggs will hatch into an alien life form capable of independent survival. The butterflies lead the expedition to one very old, apparently immortal butterfly that radiates blissful feelings of extreme happiness and peace. Does this justify the pain and misery visited upon the caterpillars, most of whom, of course, will not become butterflies, who achieve that state? The expedition can find no way of mediating between these two forms and explaining to the caterpillars that they will eventually become butterflies, the implications of that. The butterflies are convinced of the rightness of their actions and feel no compassion towards the caterpillars. It's never stated whether their belief in whether the future effects of the activities of the caterpillars is rooted in reality. The episode evokes troubling resonances around inflicting cruelty and suffering in the present for the good of a possible future state and sacrificing the many for the sake of a few. It further plays with the pervasive theme in the novel of reproduction and parenthood. The sexual act with fertilization taking place, if it does, in the bog-wallowing caterpillars is completely dissociated from the eventual parturition causing suffering and death of the butterfly. Complete estrangement amounting to antipathy prevails between the two forms. There are no pat answers, but one of the themes of the novel is that there are always going to be moral problems. And this is something that comes up again in her other novel, Solution 3. She attributed the core idea of this novel to a suggestion made to her by Jim Watson of DNA fame. In Solution 3, the transnational multiracial council governs a world that has suffered many crises, including a period known simply as aggression, that brought about the annihilation as living and food producing spaces of large parts of the Earth's surface, followed by a subsequent period of uncertainty. The council governs in what's a period still requiring careful administration of the available resources by applying a code of harmonious living, mutual tolerance and non-aggression based on the lives, example and teaching of two individuals simply known as he and she, who, though they're both dead by the time the action takes place, are being perpetuated as clones. As the novel opens, there have been several generations of clones, and the first few of these were already young adults. In spite of the nod to very up-to-the-minute discoveries, the setup of Solution 3 has intriguing resonances with a scenario advanced by J.B.S. Haldane in his 1924 Daedalus, or The Future of Science, in which he envisaged a world in which sex and reproduction had been completely separated. He depicted this future world as involving the selection as ancestors for the next generation of men and women so undoubtedly superior to the average that the advance in each generation is very startling. And he saw this as being accomplished by the implantation of fertilized ova into ectogenetic mothers by an operation which is somewhat unpleasant, though not disfiguring or dangerous. Their position was an honour, but by no means a pleasure. This seems to foreshadow major themes in Solution 3, although the potential of reproductive science had moved on by the time Mitchison was writing. The people living in the future world of Solution 3 believe, and are strongly socially conditioned to believe, that attraction between the sexes was only a snare and an aggression. The real thing was man to man and woman to woman. That alone was love. Socially approved relationships are therefore homosexual, and people do not, on the whole, break their customs and social morality and face the disapproval of their peer group for something as important as intersexual love. So you've got this whole separation between sexual activity and reproduction completely. But some people do adhere to older patterns. In particular, the professorials, the scientists and researchers, seem less susceptible to the general social conditioning away from heterosexuality. One of the main characters, Miriam, is a plant geneticist with two children, married as is still possible to her male partner, Carlo, a cytologist, though the small space of their assigned living quarters means that they cannot actually live together. The clones of he and she are implanted into clone mums, young women volunteers selected for good health who receive a number of privileges for the task. Most of these clone mums accept the situation under which, once they have reached a certain stage of development, their infants are taken away from them for the strengthening process. This is never described in detail, but is meant to replicate the adversities that made he and she the extraordinary beings they were. The clones themselves never speak of this, either when questioned by others about it or it's strongly implied among themselves. It's clearly not a pleasant thing to undergo, and the mums are aware of this. Lilac, the clone mum of F90, has become increasingly hostile to this practice. Questioning the necessity of the strengthening, she wonders whether, without it, the clones might develop different talents and other strengths. Susan Squire, in her afterword to the Feminist Press edition of the novel, suggests that Mitchison particularly identified with this situation from having herself had to give up her own sons according to the custom of her class, and in spite of her and her husband's political views, to single-sex boarding schools, even though she had known that her brother had been seriously bullied when he was at Eton. The Mitchisons had actually been criticised for keeping their sons at home until the relatively late age of 9. It would be bad for their characters, soften them. So there's, you know, quite a lot going on there. As the plot of Solution 3 unfolds, it becomes clear that aiming always for only the best may have unlooked for costs. Diversity and variety are necessary, and this is strongly brought out by the advent of impending agrarian disaster, as new, highly productive strains of major food crops are threatened by disease. It now began to seem probable that in the course of breeding high-yielding, easily harvestable hybrids, some of the genes had been knocked out, ones with unwanted characteristics, but also perhaps carrying guards against certain funguses, bacteria or viruses, which might now have found their way through. The plot turns on the search for surviving older stocks which may still have immunity. The clones themselves manifest individual differences from one another, and the council member Jussie encourages the rebellious Lilac to investigate further suggestions that have been made about non-genetic influences from their clone mums. Two of the clones even fall in love with one another in a deviant, i.e. heterosexual, fashion. And as a group, they're shown as not entirely contented with their sameness and the expectations that have been laid upon them. The council learns that by accepting change while still adhering to the central tenets of the code, by questioning and doubting and recognising that different situations require different solutions, it's possible to move ahead. Solution 3 concludes with the prospect of Solution 4. The drawbacks of apparently simple magic bullet solutions to problems are further explored in Mitchison's later novel, Not by Bread Alone, where what appears to be the answer to world hunger turns out to have adverse repercussions. Unlike many writers who have explored the possibilities of utopia, Mitchison had accumulated considerable experience in the practical business of the day-to-day, step-by-step process of working towards change, both through supporting her husband's political career in the Labour Party and her own experiences in the birth control movement, anti-fascist causes, and Scottish local politics. She manifested considerable scepticism about simple one-size-fits-all solutions to social problems. Her science fiction novels ask intriguing and pertinent questions about a range of issues, among them the questions about breeding and reproduction, which have been pervasive through so much of her life and prevalent in the circles in which she moved. From a possibly unique perspective, she undertook nuanced explorations of ideas generated by intersections between a wide range of theories, beliefs, and ideologies, from Edwardian feminist eugenics of free mate choice via interwar eugenics to the implication of Watson and Crick's discovery of the double helix of DNA. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and this is a superb paper, a very interesting one too.